That was Wade Davis, PhD, a professor of anthropology and the BC Leadership Chair in Cultures and Ecosystems at Risk at the University of British Columbia, speaking at an event entitled Beyond Declassification, Detoxifying Narratives Around the Coca Leaf, that was held at the United Nations in New York on November 7th. And for now, that's it. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!
To KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Here at KBOO, we honor the Indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tomwater, Wet'lala Bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin Kalapuya, and many other Indigenous tribes and nations of the region of the Willamette River and that great river known as Shuaneku, Wimal, Nishaiwana, and Columbia. Many names for the living water force that has sustained this region for countless generations and provided phenomenal life to our blessed ecosystems. We believe it is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationships to each other and the living world.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dot.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting lightly.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before. We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
Burned up. David D. Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. I want to talk about something that all of us should be gravely concerned about, and it is something that has already been put into motion and most definitely will be used as a weapon, a terrifying weapon. Yep. When Trump gets into office. It is House Resolution Bill or HR, House Representative Bill, HR 9495. And it's a bill that basically would allow the executive branch to look at nonprofits and say, you know what, this nonprofit is talking about police brutality, or this nonprofit is talking about Palestinian rights. We consider them a terrorist organization. Let's start to take action against them. This is something that I think many people did not have on their bingo card, did not see coming. But anybody who runs a nonprofit, anybody who is 501c3, and people in general need to be very concerned about this. Joining me this afternoon, we have Laura Kaswani from AROC, Arab Resource Center in San Francisco, and we have Ethel Longscart from WEEP. And Ethel, I always mess up the acronym. So can you tell everybody what it is so we don't mess it up?
Sure. No, it's Women's Economic Agenda Project. You know, I'm also just speaking as a human rights fighter advocate. And leader, advocate yes. for decades.
Yes. Laura, this is a fight. I'm sure you kind of anticipated it because leading the charge would be organizations like AIPAC and others that really feel threatened and have been doing everything they possibly can to diminish the type of momentum that has been garnered around solidarity with Palestinians, the fight for Palestinian rights. And I think people are looking under every rock and crevice to figure out how can we silence people. And this looked to be one way that they thought would work. And simultaneously, you look at it and go, well, heck, this can work in a whole lot of other areas as well. So talk a little bit about this, your understanding of how we got to where we're at and where we are at presently, because nothing's been put into law, but it's marching straight down that corridor.
Yeah, I mean, I'd start by saying, and as you noted, these efforts to quell dissent and free speech will often target one sector, one movement, but it's aimed actually at a broad swath, right, of any opposition to the status quo. And part of what got us to this point is over this last year, we have built, arguably the largest Palestinian movement in U.S. history in the United States. And we have solidarity across every sector. It's a majoritarian issue to call for an arms embargo and ceasefire. And yet the Democratic establishment normalized and enabled a criminalization of Palestinian solidarity on every level. And so what brought us here was actually a bipartisan interest in quelling Palestinian solidarity. And it emboldened more right-wing forces to take action such as this to attempt to completely strip our ability to do our work in the first place, right? We can bring this back to the counterterrorism laws and the ways in which Palestine was always used sort of as a testing ground that would then overwhelmingly target poor and working class Black, brown, and indigenous people in this country. The counterterrorism laws that were created to target Palestinian solidarity in the 80s. Today, the way in which the regime itself, the material support of terrorist regime and the surveillance regime have targeted Black, brown, and poor people across this country is indicative of what's to come if we allow this bill to move forward.
Laura, let me ask you this. A couple of things came to mind as you were talking. First, we should note the bipartisanship of this bill. We're focused on Trump, but there's, at last count, 58 Democrats that were like, yeah, let's do this. That's one. So let's unpack that a little. Two, what really also stands out to me, and you didn't necessarily mention it, but I think there's a lot of people rubbing their hands together and saying, this is an opportunity to get rid of progressives, radicals, and the far left. There's a proposal to bring back Rahm Emanuel, who kind of personified the DLC, the Democratic leadership, make the Democratic Party more centrist. And he, to this day, as he has in the past, have blamed any sort of shortfall of the Democratic elections. Most famously, the 2010 election, which he kind of engineered and got his butt beat because every single conservative Democrat lost. But then they pivot and say it's because of these progressives. It's because of this left wing. And if we can get rid of them, great. So this seems to be a few folks that are like, rubbing their hands together. Can we kind of unpack that aspect of this this bill.
Yeah, I mean, one thing to note, like you said, there's 52 Democrats who supported the first attempt to move this bill forward. But there have been multiple letters over the last year since the genocide started, targeting Palestinian solidarity organizations, labeling them as terrorists, targeting, including AROC, our own organization has been listed in several letters, and our fiscal sponsor Tides has been also targeted. And those letters, the criminalization of Palestinian solidarity, mostly led, as you named, by pro-Israeli institutions like AIPAC or locally the Jewish Community Relations Council and Senator Scott Wiener, have been emboldened to continue to do this work. And when we reached out to local electeds to raise alarms about our own well-being, safety for the communities we serve, for our own organizations around this smearing of our leaders and our organizations, it was dead silent. We heard from a few progressive elected leaders who spoke out and said, we want to ensure the safety of Arab Muslims and Palestinians, but mostly stayed silent. Why that's important to note, as you name, perhaps an interest in actually isolating and quelling any sort of leftist progressive agenda, is that there is a way in which Palestine represents that, right? The way in which we've built a multiracial coalition, a broad coalition of people who are anti-war, who are against US militarism, who are seeing the hypocrisy, right, of a democratic establishment saying they're for human rights and then funding a genocide led by the most fascist regime in Israeli history, saying they're against MAGA and fascism and warning us and cautioning us about the creeping in of fascism while funding and supporting fascism in occupied Palestine. So this is one example. So absolutely, we should know, and we should all be aware that if we allow this to happen, if this bill moves forward to give the executive branch the authority to strip of any organization that they label as terrorists the ability to do their work without any evidence, right? That's also important to note. How does that not stop them from doing the same thing to even something as simple as Planned Parenthood, right? Not a far left organization, but an organization that is in opposition to a Trump agenda. And then to the other side of it, how does it also allow the Democratic establishment to target organizations similar to Palestinian solidarity orgs that are also in opposition to their agenda? So it really does create a precedent that could be quite dangerous for all of us here in this country.
That's Laura Kaswani from the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, AROC. Ethel Long Scott, I wanted to bring you in primarily because of your history as a human rights organizer. And I'm always a student of history. I always like to connect the dots and remind people that what we're dealing with, that these things have been massaged and attempted and sometimes implemented before. Mm-hmm. And you've been a part of far left organizations, radical organizations mm-hmm. for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Immediately, what comes to mind is just remembering the type of restrictions that were put on, say, Black Panthers and SNCC members, told that they couldn't speak at rallies. And then eventually, organizations like that being either labeled terrorists, or at that time, what was the kiss of death, being called communist organizations, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Your understanding of this and how we should be connecting to dots to present time, is this something that is more refined and more frightening because it seems to have a different type of momentum, or are there some lessons we should learn from the past when organizations were, you know, slapped with these labels and subsequently subjected to a lot of harassment, undermining, and in some cases, you know, death?
So, yeah, I'm really glad to be on. And I think that it's important that, one, this fight, this resistance is being mobilized. I kind of go back a little further. I think the points that you've cited are very much relevant. But I look at the period that we're living through as almost the second imposition of Jim Crow government. And what do I mean by that? At the end of 1877, 1878 was the defeat of Reconstruction. Your listeners who are very astute know that this Reconstruction era, which happened post the Civil War, was established enormous public policy and efforts that were done by radical whites who were Republicans and freed Black men and women. Free Black men had the right, at least at that point, to vote and establish powerful legislatures. Now, the combination of big finance, keep that in mind, I'm sure you and their guests will remember this, who were doing railroads, who kind of looked at that good old slave system and said, well, we don't need the slaveocracy. We're going to make sure that they get their reparations. But that system of how to extract wealth looks kind of good. But we need repression in place. And so then we had it from 1878, when they removed the federal troops from protection in the South and allowed the flourishing of the KKK and all of its ilk until 1965, damn near 100 years later. Now, let's fast forward to now where we are, because when I say the second imposition of Jim Crow, Jim Crow was the first fascism in this country. It's not talked about like that. It's not taught about like that. But I don't understand what else it can be when the power of both corporations and finance combined with government established what my family came up in, which was sharecropping, which facilitated exactly the finances that Wall Street wanted. So now we fast forward to an even higher level, speculative capital, banking, finance, that is really, ruling the world. And, you know, of course, is looking and salivating at what that wonderful land that the Gazian people and Palestinian people rest upon, what that might really look like and be for the super rich of the globe. So we are up against fascists on both levels, fascists in terms of Zionists there and fascists in our own government. And I think that we have to be very clear about the time that they, it's not just normalizing, but the constant feeding to the American public that otherizing other men and women and their children as an enemy, as opposed to this system, because that I am a child of Jim Crow government. So I know this firsthand, as many of your listeners. So we aren't fighting just someplace, the effort to stop genocide there, but we're trying to stop all kinds of genocides. 800 people a day that are poor die of poverty in this country. All colors, all religions, all nationalities, all languages. And we could stop that, as Reverend Barber says. I mean, if we had had a political interest in a party that wanted to mobilize the 80 million poor, but that means you'd have to talk about things that are of interest to them. So I know I've covered some ground, but you gave me a lot of leeway there. But I think that, well, on the one hand, it's not simply history repeating itself. It's at a higher, different level, and it's requiring our movements work in a different way. So I think what is being done is extremely important, but we need both resistance and we need a movement that articulates our demands and fights for us in a unified manner.
I appreciate that. And I was very intentional about including history. One, because history is being erased and it's against the law in many places to even talk about this. And I have no qualms in believing that they would not try to nationalize that. And part of the thing that we were talking about in looking at Laura Kaswani's point, that, yeah, it starts off with Palestinians, and we could sit there and go, I ain't Palestinian, ain't my problem. You know, y'all deal with that, you know, or I can get real haughty and go, what have you done for me? But see, now we're looking at, well, what are they talking about on this airwaves right now? Huh, let's see if we can now classify this radio station as a terrorist organization, maybe because we had Laura on, or we were talking about some history, or you framed good old American history of Jim Crow as some sort of fascism, which is anti-American, and we can start getting the ball rolling in all sorts of way. And I look at all these type of incidents and connect the dots. Even when you get somebody like a Michael Strahan, former football player, you know, pundit on Good Morning America and a commentator for the football. He's a military brat. His whole family has served. He's standing, you know, during the national anthem, didn't put his hand over the heart, and they're pulling out all the stops to try to get him fired. And this is not about the fact that he disrespected the flag. This is an exercise of control. You know, can we get these people to bend to our will? So I want to bring this back to you, Laura, because in real time, Palestinians, you know, overseas are dealing with this. Palestinians right here are looking at, you know, organizations like yours and others being targeted. What sort of things should we take into account? What should be noted that hasn't been spoken about? Do we have strategies that we can share on air? I'm sure there's strategies that people are thinking about off air, but things that we can start to think about publicly as this march is happening, because I do believe this bill is going to pass and it will go to the Supreme Court, and I think they'll rubber stamp it the way that they rubber stamp the president having complete immunity, and we're seeing all of Trump's court cases disappear, including the main one today being adjourned. So how do you see this, you know, moving forward?
Well, first, I'll just say, as an organizer, you always want to think you still have the power to roll something back or to stop it from, prevent it from moving forward. So really urging folks to hit up all those Democrats, the 52 that did support it the first time around, because, you know, as much as we want to also, you know, contextualize and understand the bipartisanship of the pro-Israeli agenda, there are also Democrats who tried to espouse an anti-fascist agenda who are also supporting this fascist bill. So we do need to hold them accountable to that. That being said, one thing that hasn't been noted often enough, I think, in recent weeks and months, is the anti-fascist nature of the Palestinian struggle, right? There's a lot of people in this country who are really agitated around the MAGA agenda, agitated around the fact that, you know, there was this question of the lesser of two evils, and we, you know, there's a fascist versus somebody supporting fascism. People also are just leaving out the really essential component of the Palestinian struggle, as Ghassan Kanafani historically quotes. The Palestinian struggle is inherently anti-fascist, right? Similar to the Black freedom struggle in this country, similar to the indigenous struggle for sovereignty in this country. And if we understand it as such, it's not just about people standing in solidarity with these Palestinian organizations, right, that are being hit by this bill, or standing in solidarity because, oh, they might come for you next. But also, if we're serious about being anti-fascist in this moment, we have to take into account the Palestinian movement as part of that anti-fascist tent, right? And that it's essential and instrumental in actually mobilizing true, authentic anti-fascist politics that is internationalist, right? That is clear about the importance of joint struggle, but also brings in a class analysis and historicizes, right, this moment within a broader context within the Black freedom struggle, the indigenous freedom struggle. So I say that because what we're seeing with this bill is actually fascism creeping up on us in a bipartisan manner, right? So if we're going to allow this to continue, what we're saying is that Palestinians are disposable. And the Palestinian movement that's mobilized, it's one of the largest movements in this country in this moment. And if we're serious about defeating a MAGA agenda, we have to also include this movement that has been instrumental in mobilizing masses and become a majoritarian issue for the first time, actually, majoritarian issue bringing the question of anti-imperialism to the halls of Congress, right? And actually, for the first time this week, voting on blocking weapons to the state of Israel. So that's just one thing to note in terms of how, if we are serious about, you know, trying to stop these types of bills, also understanding that whatever comes tomorrow, whatever starts in January, whatever happens in February, that the Palestinian movement is an essential part of a political program that is serious on taking on the MAGA agenda.
Can I say,
go ahead, Ethel.
I think that's absolutely right. That's what I meant by the importance of this political moment. And I don't just mean right now at the elections. I mean, even the run up to this, particularly the run up to this. I think that what we are seeing is several things. When 2020 happened, I don't care what anyone says, 26 million Americans hit the streets for 3-4 months. And from the standpoint of the rulers of this country, it was frightening, because it was multiracial. And even if people were getting out of their house from COVID, the reality is people of all different backgrounds showed up and said, the murder of this man is a symbol of the murder that has gone on throughout our country. We don't stand with it. And our children have been at risk as well. You know, and it is not lost on me that Uvalde, I think, happened even in that same period of time. And
Uvalde, Texas.
Yes, Uvalde, Texas. And I remember just, you know, really being having such great remorse given that. But then what they had to do was kind of beat it out of us that we actually had stood together, that we actually had educated. We actually fought for policy in Congress that was ripped to shreds, right? Voting rights, the George Floyd Act, various things. something Professor Kinyanga Yamada Taylor talks about there. A part of the challenge was that that work was redirected into getting Biden elected initially, and then also getting Ossoff and the brother from
I know you're talking about the two senators from Georgia. Jewish senator and black senator.
Yes. First black senator since Reconstruction, right? Well, what are those lessons we have to take away? Some of us took away that, boy, just disappointment. We cannot count on one another. It doesn't matter. White people, white women are the enemy. And I think we have to do the unpacking, as you talked about, of where our efforts have fallen. But one thing's for certain, this question of the pitting of class versus race or class versus these nationality efforts, we have got to learn that we've got to move beyond that, because it's both under capitalism in the 21st century, always actually has been. I don't think it's ever been separate, but it's been played out in different ways. So why is that important? Because we do need a movement. I think that what we're looking at is an opportunity of a movement, a third party movement that is developing. We've heard it from some of our labor allies, because what's uppermost in my mind to both you and our guest is that this thing is implementing Project 2025. I can remember talking about this almost 2 years ago, and people were like, you guys got that, you know, you lefties got that hyperbole, and there you guys go again, talking about all of that. But it really, as an Italian person that came to one of our dialogues, she said, you mean they put this in writing, what they plan to do? Yeah, they actually did. And I think that most Americans of different persuasions were kind of thinking, well, they're not going to be deporting millions of people. They're not going to be actually blowing up babies and children's and mamas and infirm people on front of our TVs 24/7. They're not really going to do that. But this is the stage that we're at economically. We've got a system that cannot really provide for billions of people. And so from their standpoint, we're expendable. And we have the politics of Trump, the Musk, and all that. I can't call them a clown crew. I got to call them a killing crew that they represent. So I think that this is the urgent questions, the opportunities for us to build on the lessons for that, about building solidarity, that we have to protect one another. And that's a really big thing. And I mean, locally as well, because I don't know if most Americans understand what it's going to look like to have a police force in place to steal 1 million human beings a year. I mean, what that means for all of us. It's a very changed America. And I think that's why we need to have these conversations.
Ethel Long Scott, we appreciate that perspective. And Laura Kaswani from AROC. Laura, when you were talking, what I heard is, looking at what's happening with Palestinians and how you frame this solidarity as an anti-fascist movement, I would encourage people to look at the type of rhetoric in the type of framing that has been used to neutralize what you've said. It can actually be very convincing. You would not think that there's a genocide going on. In fact, you might even walk away and think that you're the one that caused it. You know, the way that it's framed, it's very sophisticated. It uses cultural references. You know, it's casual, it's not wonky. And, you know, basically like, yeah, you know, we tried to work with these people and they don't want to work with us and they're a problem. And therefore, basically, they deserve 40 and 50,000 people killed. And the reason why I say that dressing up and that massaging is that I think it's a testing ground to see how we can kind of excuse other things. So while we're looking at that and going, that sounds reasonable, there's a bunch of other people who are simultaneously looking and going, you know what, Ethel, we do need more jails and we do need more cops and we need to recall district attorneys who are actually prosecuting cops, because you see the videos and those people deserve it. And, you know, even good-hearted people are like, I want them to go to jail. And as we're saying that, what are the police unions doing to add to your point about fascism? Can we get immunity? Can we do what we want? and not be called on it and not be prosecuted and completely protected, right? Keeping in mind there's like a long list of death just with black folks. We're not even talking about brown folks, you know, by the police where they haven't been prosecuted. And that's right here on the doorstep. So while we're talking about H.R. 94-5, the bill, we better be aware that talking about anti-police stuff is going to be seen as a terrorist act, because police have already tried to position themselves that way. You know, just even talking about them in a threatening way can land you in jail. And there's a few rappers who've already gone to jail for that. You know, and so I want to kind of just build on that aspect. And then the last point to that is, yeah, those Latinos, they voted for Trump and they're going to deport him. And now you got good-minded people going, I might even call up and tell them, you know, because they feel betrayed. And first of all, for the record, I've never believed those exit polls. I don't think those exit polls are accurate, you know, and even if they were, to your point, Ethel, the Latinos that I hang with didn't vote that way. And I'm in solidarity with them, and they're in danger. But also we forget, because they Latinize immigration, you're forgetting about Haitians, Jamaicans, and a whole bunch of people. A lot of those Venezuelan folks are actually black when you see them. They're going to be under the target as well. And so to your point, Lauren, I'll let you finish up. This, if we don't understand and connect the dots that about anti-fascism, we may be lulled to sleep and be thinking that, well, it's not that bad. It's their fault. And 50 years from now, we'll be asking, well, how did you let all this happen on your watch? How did you let Palestinians be genocided, black people get shot and killed by the police, and a bunch of, you know, immigrants be deported by the millions? And it will be that sort of sophistication of not framing and not making the connections.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of, I think people have been saying this frequently recently, is like, you wondered, how did Jim Crow happen? How did the Holocaust just happen? How, you know, as students of history and living through this genocide, you're like, oh, that's how it happened. That's how they manufactured consent, right?
Yeah.
And one thing to note is, like, we're talking here as leftists, right? How do we move the progressive agenda or the leftist organizations? Part of our work is, we're not clear, right, as leftists on this question of anti-fascism and the multiple layers and intersected, you know, in like the interlocutors within anti-fascism, that we have to do that work with our bases, right? What, why Trump got elected is he did get votes from people of color. He did get votes from immigrants. He got votes from Arabs, Muslims, and Palestinians. That's just true. And we're going to, you know, we were the first ones who showed up at the airport to stop that Muslim ban, right? And then shut down SFO and shut down airports across the country. And some of those same people voted for Trump. But we can't just discount them as MAGA supporters or white supremacists. What happened is leftists lost the ideological debate. We did not offer a clear political program for our working class, poor community members across this country. And we haven't been doing the necessary, and this is a, you know, we're all reflecting in this moment, like, where are our bases? How deep are we base building in this country? How wide are we building a movement that actually is aligned politically on a vision, right, for something different? Because we can assess this election in many different ways, but ultimately people voted for change. That's, you know, that is really fundamental, like, and in terms of what has taken place. People wanted something different. The Harris campaign did not offer something different. And people are hungry. They are losing their jobs. They're struggling with finding housing. They're angry that money is going to aid in their own genocide, let alone the genocide of their neighbors and colleagues. And they voted for something different. Can we offer that alternative path and vision, whether that's a third party or just building a mass movement that's truly anti-fascist and understands our struggles as one? That is the real work that lies ahead. And lastly, I'll just say that, and I appreciate you bringing in, Ethel, the question of the Project 2025, because in addition to Project 2025 and that document that many of us have read and are and are seeing play out live, there's also Project Esther, which is a specific document targeting the Palestinian movement that is basically a blueprint for how, and in their own words, going to squash anti-colonial movements and efforts in this country, including the teaching, which would is you know, code for teaching ethnic studies, right, in this country, but specifically discusses how they want to create friction and division within the Palestinian movement, how they want to conflate anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, doing all the things we're seeing play out right now as a blueprint for the broader attack on civil rights and any freedoms that we do still have in this country.
I also think that we need to note that there are some people that will literally, you know, burn the face of the earth rather than sit down and break bread, you know, with you, because anti-blackness, anti-Arab, you know, there's some things that are more attractive than even, you know, creature comforts, you know, for some folks. I'm going to let folks kind of wrap up. But a question for you, Laura. A large swath of the population looks for answers in the electoral system, and that's something that we have to factor in, right? That's just a reality. For organizations that are leftists, what do you think we need to do, or they need to do, to really be attractive? I think there's a perception of a lot of dogma. If you don't have the right shade of gray, you're canceled out. You don't have the language, something's wrong. All these different types of things, which is like, I may listen to you, but I'm going in another direction. I'm going to go hang out over here where I don't feel like I'm under so much stress and pressure, because I just don't have the coof that you expected me to have. But how do we intentionally nurture relationships so that we're able to really understand deeply and intuitively when these attacks are coming, how they connect all the way around, and we don't kind of isolate ourselves in silos, which is happening now?
I mean, you said it right there. It's building those relationships, right? It's going back to the building blocks of organizing and doing that slow, steady, hard work of meeting people where they're at, doing the political education, creating spaces for people to feel in community in this very alienated society, right? And building out organizations with strong bases, with clear political missions and visions, and bringing people along, right? And I think that work sometimes falls to the side because we're in this rapid response moment. We're constantly reacting, responding, having to mobilize, and we get forced into that mode of being, which takes us away from the day-to-day grind of the organizing and the base building. And I think that's right. What's necessary in this moment is to do that deep relationship building, because as you noted, even the losses right here on a local level are a testament to something we are doing wrong. And at the same time, I just don't want to always be pessimistic, right? At the end of the day, we also had some wins locally, that we were able to re-elect people. And I talk about the electoral arena because that's the kind of the nature of this conversation. We were able to re-elect people into office that were very vocal about, you know, the need for housing, the need to end military aid, the supporting Palestine, supporting working class communities. So we were able to do that. And lastly, I would say as leftists, we are not strong enough in this country to pretend we can pick and choose what terrains to engage in. We need to be involved and playing a role in every terrain, in every place, because where we're not there, the opposition is going to be there.
Right. I would also add, as we close out, and then I'm going to give Ethel the last words, it's not a one-sided thing in terms of education. We can learn a lot too from our, you know, brethren on the ground. And I think sometimes we come there and go, I got language, I got understanding. But you know what? I don't know how to survive on the streets. And if the lights go out, well, that guy that's in the tent across the street, they're the smart one and I better listen to them. You know, I ain't never been to jail, right. You know, but if I got to go, homeboy next door who's been there, I need their expertise. And I think sometimes we feel we got language and understanding, so therefore I'm here to save you. No, we're here to save each other. And I think that's part of the relationship of knowing that everybody has something to offer. Okay. Laura, how do we get a hold of AROC and any marching orders? And then I'll come to you, Ethel.
Okay.
You can go to ArabOrganizing.org. You can find us on Instagram, AROC Bay Area underscore Bay Area. Would encourage you to go there so you can also take action to oppose 9495 and action to support Bernie Sanders' bill, which is for the first time ever Senate will be voting to block weapons to Israel tomorrow.
And again, that website?
ArabOrganizing.org.
Thank you. And Ethel, yeah. Scott, let me get you the last words, any marching orders, and any place you want to direct people.
Well, I think these are conversations that I think we are cherishing. I am, and want to make sure that they progress forward. And if we can think about, I don't think of myself so much in the regard as a leftist, I guess I am, but I have always worked with the people who have nothing and had to fight for the basic needs of life because the economy has been changing so rapidly and it's reorganizing to eliminate human labor. Nothing we can say. I look at my city, we have 5 decades of deindustrialization and we can point to, I talked to David D, he said, show me, talk about a politician that has stood with Black folks and has tried to, you can almost count on one hand, have consistently in our city fought to defend those at the very bottom. At this point, we have an opportunity though, and I think that's what Laura is also raising, to build unity on a different level. And I think that therein lies our opportunity. And I like the bills, of course, that Bernie is supporting, but I also know that there's labor efforts to try and build this broader effort. So I think every chance we get to resist, is we got to do it, meet it, match it. But political education has got to be integral to this work. How do we get people past what their rage? And I love what Laura said about folks from a lot of walks of life voted for Trump because they saw that billionaire as the guy who was going to fight to protect their lives. We don't like it, but we got to have a different narrative that they can rally around, right? And I think that this is that's our life work at this point. So I am really encouraged, even though I understand how dangerous a time we're living through, that that there are emerging leaders who are stepping up, and I think we need to build on that. So I thank you for the opportunity to talk with the two of you and to listen to the two of you, and I certainly love what you said, Davey, about that's a two-way street about that education, because when that works well, our movement grows and flourishes. And I'm really excited to meet you, Laura. So thank you.
We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Today, I stand before you not just to speak, but to echo the cries for freedom and peace that have resonated from the streets of Gaza to the halls of power around the world. Our hearts are heavy with the stories of suffering and injustice that continue to unfold in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Every lawmaker, especially those who attended the Democratic National Convention, should be ashamed of themselves. They should be ashamed for standing by and watching as Palestinians' constituents were not allowed on the stage to address their concerns. 40,000 Palestinians have been killed. What will it take for our humanity to be recognized?
To determine her destiny. In the shadows of power, they whisper peace. Lip service to a ceasefire, but the arms deals don't cease. From the chambers of debate to the streets, they roam. Preaching salvation while the war drones moan. Palestine must be free. Palestine must be free. cries of the fallen are just echoes in their game. Drowned out by the casual and political fame. Powders hidden lies, just poems in their plot. Human rights forgotten, justice left to rot. Palestine must be free. Palestine must be free. In the echo of the bombs, we hear the lies. The silence screams as another mother cries. It's time to stand, to raise our voice, to challenge the power, make a different choice. For every life torn apart by the fray, remember that's the price that we all pay. Palestine must be free. Palestine must be free. Palestine must be free. To determine her destiny. So hear our song, let it be known. We stand with Palestine, they are not alone. In unity and truth, our power is bound. Till the walls of oppression come tumbling down. Palestine must be free. Palestine must be free.
Business. What do I mean? In the ghetto, it's obvious. In the ghetto, we don't know how to handle our business a lot of times, so we become everybody else's business. Now a jail comes into the community. Now the jail is getting rich, bubbling, blowing up off of us. They got all our sons, our brothers, our fathers, everybody incarcerated in the jail. Other people come from miles around to work in the jail. They got jobs in the jail because we didn't know how to handle our business. The psychiatrists making money off of us because we in school wilding out and acting crazy. The pharmacist is making money off of us because our kids act so crazy in school that they gotta take pills to remain calm. The probation officer is making money off of us because we gotta check in and pee in the cup and go through all kind of hoops just to show the probation officer that we ain't gonna go crazy once we walk out of the PO's office. Everybody is making money off of the ghetto because we are not understanding the concept that we have to control ourselves and handle our business properly, otherwise other people will make business out of us. Now here's how business works. Everything in America is business. What you eat is business. Somebody had to cook it, somebody sold it to you, somebody had to transport it there. What you wear is business. What you put in your hair is business. How you comb your hair is business. The chair you're sitting on is business. The school you go to is business. Everything in America is business. That means at a young age, you have to know the difference between spending and saving. If you just see every new sneaker that comes out and decide that you got to have it, no matter how much it costs, now you done spent $150 on your kicks, you done spent $50 on your jeans and $50 on your shirt, you got enough money on your body that you could have had a computer or a trip to Europe or Africa or someplace else in the world. Every dollar that you make, you should be able to save at least 50 cents. And some of the things that you see being sold to you, you have to be able to pass and say, you know, I want it, but I don't need it. I want it, but I can't have it. I want it, but I have something else to do with my money. In In life, there are two different types of people. There are the party goers and the party throwers. Let me talk about what the difference is. The party goers are the people that sit by the radio and wait for the announcement about the next party. They're like, yeah, hey, did y'all hear so-and-so's in town? We going this. Oh, the ticket's only $20. Oh, the ticket's only $30. Oh, the ticket's only $40. What you gonna wear? Oh, girl, I seen this blouse that's in the store. It costs about $159. I'm gonna cop that. And then I'm gonna get this kind of bag. I'm gonna get these kind of shoes. You are called the party goers. You know why? Because you'll do anything to go to the party. You'll pay any price to go to the party. And you feel like you're not doing anything if you're not at the party. You're the party goers. Now, what I am is I'm the party thrower. I'm the person who rented the hall. I'm the person who said I'm going to charge $20 a ticket. Right? I already found out how many people can fit in the hall. 1,000 people can fit in the hall. I'm charging $20 a ticket. I'm definitely going to get 1,000 people in there because I done already gassed y'all up and made y'all feel like if you ain't there, then you just corny. So now you're all at the party. I got $20,000 in my pocket because there's 1,000 of y'all. 1,000 of y'all pay $20. But here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to turn up the heat so y'all get real hot. Y'all in the party just sweating. Now you're sweating on your new $200 blouse. You're like, oh, man, I need some water. Right when you say I need some water, my man's going to come out with the water cooler. He going to sell you a bottle of water for $2. You're going to be like, $2? Damn, that's too much. And I'm going to say, well, if you leave the party and come back, you got to pay all over again because once you come in, you can't go out. So if you want some water, you really got to buy it from me because nobody else is allowed to sell water in here but me. So now you got your $2 out of your pocket and now it's in my hand. Now I got $22 from all of y'all, right? Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to make the party last about 5 hours so that I can know that y'all going to get hungry. When y'all get hungry, I'm going to call my auntie out from the back. She's going to bring out the trays of fried chicken. In fact, we're going to have something for everybody. We're going to charge you somewhere between $5 and $7 for a dinner. Let's say $5. Now I got y'all for $27. Now you drank the water earlier on. Now that you got the dinner with the chicken that I told my auntie to put extra salt on, you got to get a second water. Now I got y'all for $29 each. Do you feel me? Do you understand what's going on? And that's what's going on in every area of business in America, that people are coming into our community and figuring out how to get our wealth out of our pockets and into their pockets. And if all we can think about is how we gonna get our freak on and where we gonna get our swerve on and who's doing what and where, then we just gonna be people spending, spending, spending and owning nothing. Spending, spending, spending and controlling nothing. Spending, spending, spending and having nothing. You got to handle your business or else you will become somebody else's business.
Justice, not just for the perpetrators of the war crimes at Auschwitz and in Germany, but justice also for the war crimes at Abu Ghraib, the secret CIA rendition camps, where waterboarding is an everyday commonplace occurrence, and justice for the war crimes committed in Gaza. Justice for the murders of 9-1-1-0-1, yes, and justice for the murders of August 1941 in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Folk got upset with me because my math wasn't good. My math wasn't good. I didn't do well. My mother was a math teacher. I didn't do well in math. I didn't do well in math because I couldn't understand why we got so terribly upset over 3,000 civilians, non-combatants, killed on September 11th, 2001. And we don't even bat an eye, don't even know what day in August to look at when we as America killed 144,000 civilians in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I don't do well in math. 3,000 versus 144,000. Y'all got worship services and making up songs and saying, ain't saying nothing about them Japanese. Help me understand that. Justice for people who had their land stolen from them as recorded in the books of Isaiah, Amos, and Jeremiah. And justice for the people who had their lands stolen from them as recorded in the history of America. Justice for the Seminole, the Choctaw, the Creek, and the Comanche. Justice for the Apache, the Arapaho, the Hopi, and the Navajo. Justice for the people who had their land stolen from them in South Africa by the Boers, the English, and the Afrikaners, and justice for the Khoi and San in South Africa. Justice not only for the people who had their land stolen from them, but justice also for the people who were stolen from their land. From the 19 different countries in West Africa during the transatlantic slave trade. Justice for the atrocities committed against the Jews in the Holocaust caused by Hitler, and justice for the atrocities committed against the Africans in the Holocaust caused by the transatlantic slave trade. Both Holocausts are crimes against humanity. But our government would not go to the Durban Review Conference on Racism because they don't want to call the transatlantic slave trade a crime against humanity. And as God shows over and over again in the Word of God, any crime against humanity is a crime against God, who made humans in God's image. Justice!
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, you just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone, the Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Needin' Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio. Kind of crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat till they ready from the steel gray beef. Say please, baby, they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to their lovers, I need with a please. Maybe some shade on your name in the street. Because it ain't David G.
Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
Thank you.
listening to Spill
on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Tune in every second and fourth Saturday night,
midnight
to 3 a.m.